Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Under the category of the Jewish experience, as highlighted in film, fall many, many titles over the years. And this year's Columbus Jewish Film Festival, the sixth, now the sixth annual, will highlight many of those stories. Here to speak with us today about this event, our festival chairs, June Frankel. Welcome to the show, June.
Thank you, Anna.
And also Carol Genshaft.
Genshaft,
sorry about that. Later on the show, we'll have two of the film directors, Greg Jacobs and Bob Richman. They'll join to speak with us a little bit about their works. So given that variety that I mentioned, how in the world do you spend all year trying to figure out what you're going to show? You're both nodding. Tell me, June, that experience.
Well, the selection process is really very challenging because we get to screen with our committee more wonderful films than you can possibly imagine. There's a lot of good cinema out there. And what we try to do in our selection process is to reach the widest audience we can. And we bring films with Jewish themes or by Jewish directors to Columbus and try to keep the themes as universal as possible and yet still reflect Jewish values and Jewish culture throughout the ages. So we get films from so many different countries, and we look hard at each film and how it's going to relate to every aspect of our audience.
So in a given year, Carol, how many will you look at?
We literally look at dozens and dozens of films. Our steering committee meets throughout the year, and there's kind of this circuit of Jewish film festivals throughout the country. So we kind of can see what's coming up by what is playing in other festivals that might be a couple months before ours or a season ahead of ours. And there's this kind of underground network of just many, many films that come up. And as I said, we probably screen dozens to pick our 11.
My guests, Carol Genshaft and June Frankel, they're the co-chairs for the 6th Annual Columbus Jewish Film Festival. If you have a question or comment, join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And so you said there's not a particular theme this year, June?
Well, yeah, in some ways there is a particular theme. It's a lot of overcoming obstacles and people's worlds turned upside down for various reasons. A lot of heroes involved in our films, a lot of role models, and some really great acting going on here. We have about half documentaries and half feature films this year, and each of them brings a different, very engaging conflict to the fore. So I think they're going to appeal to everybody. People ask me what my favorite films are.
Which is what I was
going to
ask
you. I can't direct them. They're all so wonderful.
Well, when you think about what you're really excited for other people to see, because they're obviously all fabulous, or you wouldn't be using them, you know,
exactly.
Showing them in this. But as far as exposing people to something fresh and new that maybe you think maybe they haven't seen yet in Columbus so far.
Well, I think that's what's so great about the festival. We don't just show the films, but we also have these wonderful programs around them. So, for example, this year, in fact, I think you're interviewing the director of Ahead of Time. Well, in addition to the film, that film is about a woman who is now 99 years old and still going strong. And she, when we saw this film, we fell in love with it. We were just completely inspired by this woman. And we looked around and said, well, you know, there are a lot of people in their 80s and 90s in our own community who are inspiring as well, who continue to serve, volunteer, to be artists. And wouldn't it be fun to recognize some of those folks in our own Jewish community? So we have put together a program called Great Over 80 in conjunction with the screening of that film. And I think that's what makes the film festival so special, is that we can do that sort of thing and bring in this case, it will be an audience of those seniors who and their families. Another one, you're interviewing Greg Jacobs later,
He's a Columbus native.
He's a Columbus native, and the film is about a poetry slam in Chicago. Well, here, this gave us the opportunity to partner with folks at Columbus Public because their high schools are very much involved in poetry slams. So we're going to have some of their students actually perform some of their poetry after the screening at our Doc Sunday on November. I think that's November 14th. So whatever the film is, we try and draw in kind of audiences that certainly cross Jewish boundaries, not just the Jewish community, but the greater community. And the whole idea is to get dialogue going and discussion and bring together people that might not have come together otherwise.
I guess, you know, Greg Jacobs is a native. He's Jewish. Why? He's the Jewish filmmaker. But there is a thread of the Jewish experience in that story that's a lot of fun, and it is very cross-cultural. So was that an obvious when you see these things? Because Greg Jacobs is from Columbus, you're like, bingo, that's an obvious. Or what? When do you have to talk with other people and decide, right?
Yeah, and I think that one came about because of the connection to Columbus. I don't think that film is particularly on the Jewish Film Festival circuit, but it's been in many, many international film festivals and actually won an award in several towns, Cleveland and Austin. So that one is just kind of serendipitous. And as you mentioned, there is a main character in that documentary who is Jewish and brings a nice thread of that about. But it also brings together, you know, folks from different races, ethnicities, religions, genders. So it kind of crosses all those boundaries.
What makes Columbus's different or unique? Unique's a strong word, but what sets it apart?
The film festival?
Yes.
I think if you had, film people that were volunteers or professionals in all the cities, they'd say the same thing. That's the beauty of it. We are able to kind of localize it and look at our community. A good example is I think that's on November 15th, we're screening a film about Will Eisner, who is known as the father of the graphic novel and of cartooning and comics. Well, when we saw that screen come through, and he happens to be Jewish, there's a Jewish thread that runs through the film, but I happened to work at the Columbus Museum of Art and knew of our current exhibition, of course this was a year ago, that was coming up, The Bible Illuminated, R. Crumb's Book of Genesis, which is a graphic novel. And so, you know, I saw that film and the lights just went on and I said, oh, this would be a great film to complement the exhibition. So we're having that event at the museum. It will be preceded by a tour of the exhibition and then a reception, and the director, the filmmaker, will be in as well. So I think we look for those kind of nice places where Columbus kind of matches up with the films that we're looking at, and that's what makes it so special.
Oh, and not to mention we have a cartoon lab down at OSU.
Some
of us have taken classes down there, and we learned, well, we took the graphic novel class, that there is more than a Jewish thread, more than Jewish guys involved in Jewish comics just because they are good at it. It's just that the Jews were banned from the publishing field. It was very hard to get into publishing in the 30s. And the Jews who wrote and those who drew as well started the comic book trend and write comic books because they weren't allowed entry into the publishing field. So it was sort of a byproduct of anti-Semitism. And the story is told that way, as with our Jews and Baseball film, A Love Story. I mean, this really tells a lot of the Jewish experience, where Jews made something out of, you know, a difficult situation and created their own art forms and their own, you know, different specific styles of immigration and success.
Is it just an unending font of topics?
Because
I was watching the film about Ruth Gruber, and I was like, oh my gosh, she's been around forever. She's 99 now. I think when the film was made, she was 96 or 97, around there. And I think it's almost scared me to think that we might have waited too long. A filmmaker might have waited too long and not have captured her essence.
She's been captured, but at 99, it's an incredible story,
right,
just by her age. But yes, she's been captured. She's written books.
She's been to the
Jewish book fair several times, so people are really familiar with her character here in Columbus.
Yeah.
So.
So when it comes to someone like that, though, it just made me think about how deep that well must go.
It's true. And I think I was thinking about this, because Jews live in the diaspora, of course, there's Israel now, but Jews have been dispersed all over the globe. And I think the film festivals here in Columbus and elsewhere reflect that. So this year we're showing films from, of course, the United States, from Argentina, from France, from Israel, from Germany. And every year it's that kind of mix. And I think that makes it that much more interesting.
What are some of the other events? You mentioned the Over 90. What else are you doing for the community to bring them in?
Well, our big opening is this coming Sunday, November 7th, and we're showing two fabulous films. And you know, if you're Jewish, you have to involve food. So in between the two films, we're having a wonderful supper reception. And the first film is A Matter of Size, which is an Israeli film. Pretty lighthearted, but about perhaps many people out there can commiserate with. It's four greatly obese gentlemen who really are what you would call losers, and they're having a real problem. They're even getting kicked out of Weight Watchers. And so they decide to form a sumo wrestling group in Israel, and that's the kind of
is that
format.
A fictional?
Or yes.
Is that
it's fictional. This one's definitely
nowadays,
fictional.
I don't know.
And you're right. I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, in some ways, like with Ruth Gruber, you couldn't make her up. I mean,
no,
she's so amazing.
That story is so amazing. Mm-hmm. This one's amazing, too, but no, it's not true. And then we're having this wonderful buffet supper in between. And then the second feature is A Secret, which is a French film, which is a very serious film. It's directed by Claude Miller, and it was from a autobiographical novel by Philip Grimbert about the book was called Memory, a beautifully written book, a Holocaust story about loss and redemption, and it's beautifully filmed. So it's a great double feature, and we hope there's tickets still left. We hope lots of people will still come out.
Okay, and if folks want to learn more about the film festival, where should they go?
Oh, our website is phenomenal. It has everything. It's www.cjfilmfest.org. And they can find out about the venues. They can get video clips of the films. They can.
There's links to all the films.
Links to everything, all the publications.
All right. And you can buy the tickets online.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, we'll put a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. I want to thank my guests. You'll be with us for the rest of the hour, though. So if anybody has a question, my guests, Carol Genshaft and Genshaft.
Genshaft.
Now I'm completely. And June Frankel, the co-chairs for the Columbus Jewish Film Festival. I hope you have a great show.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us today.
It was great.
See you at the movies.
I hope so. When we return, we will welcome to the show Greg Jacobs. He is a Columbus native and director of Louder Than a Bomb. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
I've only shown one at a time. I haven't taken both horses to the horse shows.
The change, Tillman says, is because of the down economy.
As opposed to spending $1,500 at a horse show, I'm only spending $700 at a horse show.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Election 2010 could mean big changes around the country and in Ohio. Join WOSU News tonight, beginning at 8, for an NPR News Election Night special, including local updates from the WOSU News team. Listen right here on WOSU 820, on the web at WOSU.org, or follow us on Twitter at WOSU News. Sunny skies today, a high near 51. Clear skies tonight, a low of 32. Right now, 38 degrees. And All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now is Columbus native Greg Jacobs. He's director of Louder Than a Bomb. It's an ode to the writer-performers who compete in the annual Louder Than a Bomb Teen Poetry Slam in Chicago. Greg is co-founder of Siskel Jacobs Productions. Before that, as vice president, chief creative officer for Towers Productions, he oversaw the content of more than 200 documentaries on five different networks, including A&E, Discovery, The Weather Channel, and CNN. He has a master's degree in history from The Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
What's the story of Louder Than a Bomb? We know it's a poetry slam, but what's the story?
There is a high school poetry slam competition every year in Chicago called Louder Than a Bomb. And what it is they build the event around teams. So you have kids from, 50, 60, and now about 70 different schools who compete as teams for 2 or 3 weeks in competitive spoken word poetry, where they get up, they do their poem, they get judged by judges, and the accumulated scores, whichever team scores the best, wins. And the great thing about Louder Than a Bomb is that the kids work all year on their poems, on their group poems, with the assumption that they are there for a competition. And when they get to the competition, it's a total bait and switch. And after 2 or 3 weeks of listening to kids from neighborhoods that they have never been to, kids they would otherwise never meet, and hearing their stories and telling their own stories, they realize that actually the competition wasn't really the important thing after all. It was really the community that they construct over those 3 weeks. And it's kind of a transformative thing for the kids.
Let's hear for those among us who maybe don't know what we're talking about when we say poetry slam. This is a clip of one of the main characters, Nova, performing a poem about her dad.
By the time I was 10, I was your wife, your sister, your mother, your best friend, and you were bitter. I would feed you chicken soup when you were sick, kiss your forehead to see how bad your fever was. But I'm 17 now, and we don't even talk. But I guess you're too busy rusting like cement windows to notice that your baby girl is a woman. And how my memory will fade like your four-finger sangria, two gin, two tonic, and one lemon juice.
Greg, did their talent sort of blow you away?
I mean, I think it's one of the things that surprises people when they see the movie. That comes very early on in the film, and we were watching it yesterday with an audience of high school students and some of their parents. And sitting behind a woman, by the end of that poem, again, about 10 minutes into the film, she starts frantically reaching for her purse, and I didn't know what she was doing. And then all of a sudden she pulls out, a crumpled up Kleenex and starts wiping her eyes and her nose. And I think people are just, when they hear high school poetry, you maybe have the associations of the, for example, the awful poetry I wrote that we'll never see.
Exactly. That's all I can think about is mine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and God forbid that ever
right.
gets read in public. So I think people have that association, and when they see the film, they are so stunned at how good the kids are and how thoughtful they are as writers and how well-constructed the pieces are and how incredible they are as performers. That I think the surprise really adds to the joy of the film.
The film follows the paths of, is it three? It's four, isn't it?
It's three kids who are on teams, and then one team
right.
that is so inseparable that it's impossible really to treat them as one.
Okay. How did you select those competitors? What inspired you to focus on them?
Well, one of the things that we knew, I think, right from the start was to do an hour and a half film, the poetry had to be pretty great. There's some 500 or 600 kids who do their poems at Louder Than a Bomb, and they're all brave and they're all moving in their own way, but they're not necessarily all what you would say is great poetry. It's great that they're doing it, but but the works themselves, can sometimes be nervous or frightened or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these were kids that really stood out as we were doing our research, who were both, they're not just interesting kids and interesting characters with great stories, but they were also, real clear standouts. One of the things that we love about Louder Than a Bomb is that everybody gets support. It's this odd combination of what was called a combination of democracy and meritocracy, where everybody supports everybody, but they also really respect the kids who can really do it well. And these were kids who were obviously great poets, but were also respected by their peers as, you know, the best of the batch. So they really jumped out at us.
There is maybe an unexpected Jewish thread through it in the form of Adam Gottlieb. I just loved looking at Adam, his wonderful eyes. I just wanted to kiss him to death or something. Yeah. I don't know what it was about that guy. 17-year-old Adam Gottlieb. Let's listen to a portion of him performing a poem about being a poet.
Everybody's got something to say about poetry. Because rhymes peak in meaning, shedding light on our unspeakables. For an ample example, take the other day when I sat not knowing how to write a poem, and assuming I was fruitlessly booming the thin air, I yelled and spat my frustration. How do I start? And my dog looks up from her water dish and says, I hate to encroach on your artistic space, because I know you're like in the zone or whatever, but if you really want my advice, here it is. And then my dog says, poet, breathe now.
That seemed so much like a poem for his fellow competitors. It was just to them. It was an ode to them or something.
It really is. And he is is sort of the spirit of the whole event in a way. In a way, he's sort of an unusual character for a documentary because he's so normal. He's just a sweet kid with great loving parents and, thoughtful and loved by everybody. But he kind of, in a sense, anchors the film because he's sort of the kind of spiritual center of it. And that poem we always think of as our secret weapon, because Adam is kind of presented in a way. He's a little nebbishy, very much, he looks like somebody you don't expect to get on stage and be as commanding as he is. And then he starts to do that poem, and it's like a snowball going down the hill. And by the time people are done, people applaud in the theater, which is great.
Greg, I'm going to ask you to hold the phone just a little farther away from your mouth. We're getting some intense static. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Let's listen to another clip. This is Kevin. He's performing a part of a poem, a portion of a poem, and then he talks about this creative process.
My mouth speaks what my eyes see, what my mind justifies, and what my heart tells me. Society doesn't want to be exposed. I write with my eyes closed and my hands behind my back because black struggles are so common. What I spit writes itself.
Lamar, he'll come back with like four pieces.
Well, I got all these pieces. What y'all been doing?
But he's more about the scores, more about winning. And I keep telling him, it's not always about the points. You got to really, focus on the poetry. You can't like really rush it.
Every line should be a jewel, right? So I'm trying to pack so much into a poem, so later on in my years, when they reread it,
right,
and they look over it like,
right,
I probably didn't catch it the first time.
They're going to go on to tell them it's really about the moment. It's not about what someone's reading 100 years from now.
Right, exactly. It's funny. We didn't expect it, but people tend to, there tends to be a little bit of laughter in the theater at that line. Because the notion of a teenage kid writing for posterity seems a little ridiculous. But Kevin and Lamar are sort of the yin and yang of the process in a way. And in a sense, they kind of flip roles by the end.
How did you come to this topic?
It was a total fluke, actually. I was driving down Clark Street near Wrigley Field in Chicago with my wife, and there happened to be a marquee on a famous nightclub there called the Metro, sort of like the Newport of Chicago. And it said, Louder Than a Bomb High School Poetry Slam Finals tonight. And there was a line of kids of all shapes and sizes and colors and whatever down the block. And it was just so unusual to see that kind of diversity among kids on the north side of Chicago. And then the thought that they were all there to see poetry on a Saturday night, that was, I don't remember that from high school as a way of being entertained. And that also meant that there were kids on stage reading their poetry. So it just was one of those things where we just decided, well, let's take a look at this. This seems interesting. And every step of the way it was.
It kind of follows the kids over the course of a school year, right?
Exactly.
And the Poetry Slam is at the end in the spring sometime?
Yeah, the Poetry Slam is usually in early March or so.
How did you decide what moments during their preparation? For one thing, as filmmakers, could you be there all the time? And how did you decide when to be there and what to keep?
We ended up shooting about 350 hours of footage. And I think if our editor, John Farbrother, if he had his way, it would be a 350-hour film. I think he likes that. That would be the editor's cut. Maybe down to 100 or 150 hours. But there was so much great material, and the real challenge, it took us 2 years actually to edit it, because the challenge was weaving these stories together so you got a real sense of the event, a sense of the kids, and you're energized by the story itself, by the excitement of who's going to win or who's not going to win. And that was really challenging. But I think it turned out well, and there's a lot of stuff that we wish we could have gotten in there, couldn't quite make the cut.
At the very beginning, there's one of the poets talks about how he was always getting in trouble and always making his dad cry. And then this was the first thing he'd ever done that he meant to make his dad cry over.
Yeah, that's Lamar. It's a moment that at the very beginning that's just supposed to kind of shake you out in a way. I think people sort of come to the film expecting a certain thing. And I was talking to somebody yesterday who'd seen it, and they said by the end of his little speech that starts the film, mm-hmm. they were hooked already.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're so interested in finding out what is it about the power of this event and this work that clearly changed or structured this kid's life so that he's on the right path now.
At the outset with Nova, that's the girl we heard performing a poem about her dad. It seems to be all about her dad, but then she evolves.
It's one of the things we were acutely aware of all year is that, oh, right, these are 17-year-olds, and they are changing week to week and not just through the school year. I think Nova started out really thinking that that was going to be her mission this year, was to write, sort of get her thoughts about her father out to the world and then be done with them. And by the end of the year, she was thinking so much about her brother, who has severely special needs. He has something called Fragile X syndrome, which comes with a whole host of other problems.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been sort of a second mother to him. And so she starts realizing as she's getting close to the end of her senior year, she's going to be somewhere else for the first time in her life. And she's not going to see him every day, and she's not going to be able to interact with him and essentially, serve as that second mother. So she kind of writes a poem dedicated to him, and it is just a stunning poem. I mean, in its honesty and ferocity.
And in the way it builds.
And in the way it builds, and in just some of the revelations that she has midway through. She talks about, at one point, about how the most powerful line is about how her father used to say, put Cody, who's the name of the son or of his son, in the middle of the back seat, so that if they have a car accident, he would be the one to die. And by the time she is done, it's just people are just stunned and silent. But you can see the sort of relief that she gets in getting that out into the world. And then people then come up to her afterwards and say, I have a similar situation, and thank you for saying that. And it's such a reinforcing, positive thing.
Yeah, there was a thread of her dad in that. It was almost as if she thought, what's the crappiest thing he ever did or said? And that might have been it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And you have to also realize she's a teenager, so
right.
The reliability of the reporting, I think we just have to trust her, because she is so trustworthy. But teenagers have feelings about their parents, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, speaking of teenagers, I've interviewed a few of them in my day, and they're not always the best interview, even if they are artistic and creative and talented, and they may even be writers and so forth. And I was wondering about having the eye of the camera on them. How much were you concerned about changing the dynamic? Because they're so media conscious now.
Yeah. I mean, I think you always are when you make a documentary, and we try to leave as little trace as possible, but it's inevitable that there's going to be a little bit of sort of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle of life, where just our presence will change things slightly. But these kids, I mean, you're right, they are so media savvy. They're used to broadcasting themselves on, at the time, MySpace and now Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and they're also, in a sense, in this way, for our film, self-selected as people who are willing to get up on stage and talk about their most personal things. It was almost a filtering process. By the time we picked these kids, we knew these kids would be great talkers, and great, very self-reflective, which is not always the lot for teenagers. And they turned out to be incredibly articulate about their own worlds, about why they do it, about what they were going through. So there was never any sense of, oh boy, we're in trouble. You know, we have mumbling teenagers who can't talk about anything. It was almost the opposite.
Well, the teachers must have been amazing to meet as well.
Yeah, I mean, they are, I always call
the
them
coaches, the kind of, I should say.
The coaches, well, yeah, and they are teachers too. The kind of secret heroes in all of this. The film really, really connects with educators. Because when they see the sacrifices that these coaches and teachers are making, really with no extra pay, I think they tend to see themselves at their best in them, in the film. And sort of the embers of why they got into teaching in the first place get rekindled in a way, because these teachers are clearly so loving of the kids and so self-sacrificing, and so effective, and it's a pretty amazing thing to see. And one of them will actually be there at the screening at the festival. Nova's coach Peter Kahn, who is a Upper Arlington native and an equally big Ohio State fan as I am, will be with us at that screening.
You know, there's the irony that we so often we associate, particularly with central city schools, inner city schools, those kind of urban places, that the only thing these kids have to get them out of there is athletics. And
yeah.
Then there's that poem about, well, it's not about LeBron James, but it's...
Yeah. Nate Marshall, who's a real superstar, he writes a poem that starts off as saying he is LeBron James's biggest fan. And it's a kind of ode to all the people who would love to be LeBron James but aren't anywhere near it. But by the end, he sort of reframes it as he is the LeBron James of poetry, the first spoken word brother with a shoe deal.
Exactly.
And so it's a very funny poem, but it sort of encapsulates kind of his story as somebody who had to make a choice between sports and writing and chose writing.
You mentioned that it took you 2 years to edit it. I was wondering if you've followed any of the kids into college or wherever they went.
Well, it's both the beauty and the curse of Facebook, I think,
okay.
That they have followed us as well. So it turns out that you learn a lot more about what's really going on in their worlds through Facebook than you do through their interviews, because suddenly you're seeing things that, oh, please, I didn't really need to know that.
Right.
But we are in touch with all of them. In fact, for the premiere in Chicago, we flew them all back, which was kind of amazing because Nate is doing a semester in South Africa. So we flew him back from South Africa. We flew Adam back from Puerto Rico, and Nova back from where she's in school, and had sort of a mini reunion. So it was great. It was sort of getting the band back together one more time. It was wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you, Greg Jacobs, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Greg Jacobs, director of Louder Than a Bomb. It is one of the films that will be shown during the 6th annual Columbus Jewish Film Festival. Greg, thanks again, and we have to take another break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media and The Refectory for our first-ever Chefs in the City wine tasting, Friday, November 19th at 5:30 p.m. Guests will sample hand-selected wines and taste exclusive creations by Chef Richard Blondon. You'll also be part of a special WOSU TV production on how food and wine are paired. A limited number of tickets are on sale now at wosu.org/chefs or by calling 614-688-3777.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And on Election Day, we'll talk about political trends, polls, and early returns. Joining Ann in the studio is Ohio State University Political Science Professor Emeritus Herb Asher and Columbus Dispatch reporter Daryl Rowland. That discussion begins at 11 on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting Leanne Rimes, touring in support of her upcoming release, Lady and Gentleman, Sunday, November 7th at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
38 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 51. Clear skies tonight and a low of 32. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I want to return to our earlier guests, Carol Genshaft and June Frankel, the co-chairs of the Jewish Film Festival in Columbus's sixth annual Jewish Film Festival. Let's talk about the venues very quickly, and tell me, you know, Greg Jacobs is going to be in town for this. Of course, he's from Columbus. I didn't reiterate that at the end, so he'll be here. Tell us about that day. You called it Doc Day.
Well, we call it Doc Sunday, and it's become a tradition with our film festival where we show three or four films on a Sunday, and we have bagels and coffee offered all day long at the Gateway Cinema. So it's been a very successful program, and we just don't want to give it up. This Louder Than a Bomb will be one of the selections that will be screened there with a program, as we said before, with some performances by the Columbus Public Schools kids. The earlier films on that day will be two other films. One is Off and Running, and it's really a remarkable film, a documentary, again, about a white Jewish lesbian couple who have adopted three mixed-race children, and they grow up in a very loving home. And at some point in their development, in particular, the middle child, whose name is Avery, seeks a connection with her biological mom, and this sort of propels a whole sequence of events that impacts her adolescence and derails her for a while. But it's a great story. Avery will be there to speak and to answer questions after the film. So that should be a great
film. Is Ahead of Time going to be that day?
Ahead of Time will be on the 9th, which is prior to this. This is on the 14th.
All right.
This is, again, at the Gateway. So we do have other documentaries, but there are three on that day, the first of which is Off and Running. The second one is Jews and Baseball, and that lines up, I think, at about 1:30, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the assimilation and integration. Oh, okay, of Jews in the game of baseball on every level. It's a fascinating film. So all three of those documentaries are superior. 14th of November.
Joining us now is Bob Richman. He is the multiple award-winning director of Ahead of Time, a multiple award-winning documentary about the life of Ruth Gruber. Ruth Gruber is the youngest PhD in the world before going on to become an international foreign correspondent and photojournalist at the age of 24. She was an adventurer, a savior, an ambassador. But her voice, literally, and as a writer, is a treasure. Bob Richman is an award-winning cinematographer and director of photography. He is an Academy Award winner for An Inconvenient Truth and an Academy Award nominee for My Architect. He has many other awards as well. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I just want to correct you. I'm not an award winner for those. You know, the film wins the award.
Okay.
As a cinematographer, I'm not a nominee or an award winner.
All right. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
How did the story of Ruth Gruber come to your attention?
Well, I live in Montclair, New Jersey, and I was coming out of the dry cleaners, and Ziva Olbaum, who is the producer of the film, stopped me in the street and knew that I worked in documentaries. She had never made a documentary before, and she started to pick my brain, as many people do. I think in Los Angeles, everybody has a screenplay. In New York, it seems like everybody has a documentary they want to make. And so she started talking to me about the project, and that's how I came to be involved.
How old was Ruth when you started to work on the project?
96.
Were you worried? She was 96. She's 99 now. What's to worry about?
I was worried, but for no reason, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started the project as quickly as possible, and I wanted to get the interviews with her under my belt as quickly as possible. But she'll probably outlive me.
Yeah. She is a glowing presence.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She has a real life force and just a wonderful person.
Let's hear a clip from the trailer for the movie. In this clip, she talks about her desire to get away, to get out of Brooklyn.
My father, he'd say, you have to have a career. I said, I want to be a writer. What kind of career is that for a nice Jewish girl?
Ruth Gruber is a writer and a lecturer and is the youngest PhD in the world and is quite good looking.
I was a rebellious kid. I wanted to encompass the whole world. I wanted to know what everything was like. So that really set my whole course.
How did you scrunch her life, her amazing life, down to, how did you even begin to edit it down?
Well, you know, the film isn't a real biography in the sense that it ends when she's 36 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, every time I watch the film, I think of all the things I left out, these amazing stories she told us. Even in that 36 years, you have to leave out so much. The true arc of the film and what the film is about is her self-actualization, her becoming the person who she was. You know, by the time she realizes what her life's work is during the Haven episode, and then she sort of achieves that with the Exodus episode. And then from there on, she goes on to live that life. But it's really the arc of her becoming this journalist and what, you know, her life's work is going to be. And that's what the arc of the film is. I wouldn't call it a biography because it just, you know, it ends when she's 36. She's 99 now.
But she lived more in those 36 years. She started college when she was 15 years old.
Yes, she's quite amazing.
and she could have been the youngest PhD of her time, and that might have set her apart, but she went on to do many amazing things. What did you make sure you didn't leave out of this film?
Those are those amazing points. You know, the fact that she was the youngest PhD, the fact that she went to a Hitler rally, that she was at the Nuremberg trial, the Haven story, her time in Alaska, you know, working with Ickes, and then covering the Exodus story. Those were the things that I thought just was the arc of who she became. I mean, what's amazing to me is, you know, she learned German, and that just led to everything. Now, if she had learned French instead of German, you know, I don't know where, I'm sure she would have gone just as far, but maybe the arc would have been completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was all because she had a crush on her German teacher at NYU. So
the things, places, crushes will take us. Let's hear another cut from the movie. It is Ruth has taken a photo of refugees raising a huge flag. They painted the swastika on top of the British Union Jack, and they were defying not only the British Empire but also the whole world. And this photo became Life magazine's photo of the week. Let's hear Ruth talking about that moment.
And I said to myself, that's history. That flag is history. So I shot rolls of film. The British Consul General Ashcroft saw my camera. He said, I demand the camera and I'm going to sue you and sue the Herald Tribune. And I just turned on my heel and left him and got back to my hotel and called the editor-in-chief of the Herald Tribune in Paris. And I told him the story. And he said, who has the pictures? And I said, what do you mean I have them? And later he told me, they don't belong to you. They don't belong to the Herald Tribune. They belong to the world.
She was a photographer as well.
She was. And, I mean, the thing about Ruth was she learned photography, I don't think out of a passion for being a photographer. She learned it because she needed to. You know, she needed, in those days, they didn't send a photographer with the journalist. So she knew that she had to learn photography herself. And here's another case where she rises to the occasion and uses both her skills as a writer, as a journalist, covering the story, following it. She doggedly followed the story to find out where these refugees were taken. And then, you know, gets on this boat, and one of the few reporters who were allowed on the boat, and takes this very historic photograph that goes around the world and really changes opinions around the world about the refugees, the war refugees at that time. So she brings to bear all her skills And that's why, for me, it's such a, you know, a moment in her life where everything seems to come together.
She was a journalist photographer, but she also had an incredibly artistic eye for photography and balance. And some of the photos that she took that you showed in the film from the Arctic trip were fabulous.
Yeah, well, the photos were from Alaska.
Okay, Alaska, I'm sorry.
Because I don't think she was yet
using
a camera in the Arctic. She
okay.
was actually, she was only 24, I think, when she went to the Arctic. So she was not yet a photographer. She was more a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when she went to Alaska, she started, and in fact, that film, the actual film is her film also. You know, she's in it, so somebody else was still also shooting with that camera. But the films of the Eskimos were her films also, and the photographs. And she, you know, she took beautiful photographs. And the photographs that are also, not only the photograph of the flag, but the photograph she takes of the refugees in the belly of the boat and the light coming through. And she tells this wonderful story, which, you know, she got down there, it was really dark. And then all of a sudden this light came through this little window. And that's when she shot these really beautiful photographs.
She had that knack. There was a moment in the film, I was listening to it this morning while I was, you know, kind of preparing, and where she said, "That's what I knew. That was the story." It was about something completely different, but she had that knack of knowing the moment and knowing exactly what the point was.
Yeah, she was a real journalist at that time, and, you know, there weren't that many women journalists, and supposedly even later in life she would sit by the TV. She'd have three TV sets going with all the major news stations all the time and be watching it, and she had a sense for news and how important it was.
You know, I could just listen to her alone. I could have for the entire time. But you also wonderfully wove the story with archival film footage and photographs, many taken by Ruth, as we mentioned. And now I know that the film footage was as well, some of it. How do you figure that equation between her voice and her image, which is fabulous, and the other sources for that story?
Well, you know, for a feature-length film, you do not – it would even be tough to have one person talking, one
mm-hmm.
talking head. And I think the archival footage adds so much to her story. And I also, there are these scenes, and one of the things when I first, because if you know my history, most of the films that I've worked on are present tense stories, whether it's the September issue or they're stories that are cinema verite stories that are something that's happening at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a past tense story. But when I met Ruth, what interested me about it was not only the past tense story, which was amazing, but was this woman now, her present tense, the Ruth, the 96-year-old Ruth, fascinated me. And I wanted it always to be a film about two Ruths, the young Ruth and the old Ruth. And there are all these scenes with her interacting with other people. And I tried to bring both. And the way my editor, Sabina, helped me was we decided that these verite scenes where she's with other people were a doorway into the past. So you see her in the present interacting with somebody who's somehow involved with her past. And that brings you into the past and brings you in. And the archival footage helps you to go back into the past. And that's how we try to structure the film.
It's pretty clear by now to the listeners that Ruth Gruber wore many hats during her career. So in this clip that we're going to hear from the film's trailer, we'll hear about two of those roles.
My mother said, "Mr. Secretary, you're sending my daughter to Europe now in the middle of the war. How do I know she'll come home safe?" "Don't worry, Mother. We're making her a general."
So you were not just a journalist?
Never.
Never.
She had a pretty amazing relationship with Harold Ickes, too.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us about why did he put so much trust in her, had so much confidence in her?
You know, I can't really answer that question. I get the feeling he had he worked very much by his gut. And I think it seems from his diaries that when he met Ruth, he just had this great feeling about her and just knew right away that she was somebody he could trust. in somebody who would do the job that he wanted. And he had read her book on the Arctic, and he was fascinated with Alaska. He really wanted to bring the war refugees to Alaska. That was what he was pushing for. And he understood the importance of Alaska in many different ways. And so Ruth was, as she says in the film, became his eyes and ears, and traveled for 18 months throughout Alaska. And then she did an amazing job, so, you know, he kept her on when she came back to Washington,
but
D.C.
Congress, or at least some members of Congress, wanted to cut off the funding for that.
Yes, because they saw her book about the Soviet Arctic as being somehow communist, and that she was a communist. And I mean, what she says in the book, in the movie, really, is that they were really after Ickes. The Republicans were after Ickes, and they were using this as just a way to get to him. But, you know, they would have destroyed her career, you know, without thinking at all about it, just to get to him. They didn't really care about this woman. He stood by her, and eventually the Congress relented and let her get paid to do this job.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to mention that point in her life when she escorted the 1,000 Jewish refugees. She told them that they were the first witnesses and that they had a story to tell the people of the United States. Again, that journal, that sense of the storytelling in her.
Yes. I, you know, it's amazing, first of all, she flies into war-torn Europe in 1944, and it was actually quite dangerous. The boat was actually attacked by the Germans on the way out of Europe. And that's another story that's not in the film, but she tells about them being attacked and how she runs and helps to calm the refugees who are, you know, upset, obviously, and scared. And what she did was to go and try to calm them down. So it was an amazing story. And then she becomes their mother, so to speak, when they come to the United States, and helps them to adjust and helps, you know, push for their being able to stay, because they had all signed papers saying they would return to Europe, which made no sense at all to anybody, because there's no place to return to for these people.
Bob Richman, director of Ahead of Time, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Appreciate it. And also Carol Genshaft and June Frankel, co-chairs of the Jewish Film Festival in Columbus's 6th Annual Jewish Film Festival. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.